Welcome to NeuroNoodles Neurofeedback and Neuropsychology Podcast, featuring tech legend Jake Gunkelman. He's the man who has read well over 500,000 brain scans, and Dr. Marie Swingle, author of iMinds. Our goal is to provide information and promote options for better mental health. The NeuroNoodle Podcast is supported by listeners and businesses just like you. Hello, Beverly.
Hello there.
What you got?
Well, I'm happy to be here today. I kind of, you know, feel a little special getting to be on the NeuroNoodle Podcast, so thanks for having me.
This is a low-key conversation. We'll have Jay Gunkelman pop it. There's Jay. Just a bunch of friends getting together, talking about the old noodle.
That is excellent.
Dr. Mike.
Hello.
And hello, Jake Gunkelman. Say hello to Beverly.
Hey, Beverly.
Hey there. Good to get to see you again. It's been a while. I was interacted with you a little bit, I think, last year with Evian.
Well, any friend of Evian's a friend of mine. So
listen, I still can't believe that I got to meet and work with that man. So just a transformational experience.
Well, he has been a bit of a mover and a shaker for quite a long time.
No,
and,
you're absolutely right.
As an integrative neuroscientist, I think that perspective has really helped a lot, kind of bringing things together. And he was one of the early fans of my endophenotype model. I thought it was a fairly transformational approach. So it was good to see his opinion, you know. You never know.
Well, I know. And his opinion, you know, just through his years of experience. And I will just share with your listeners, too. When I first started working with him, we would get on these calls. And, you know, I didn't quite understand his stature. And it was almost as if you were in a rock star moment as you're, you know, you're training people or you're talking to people. And it took me a while to adjust to that because in the world, he is so well known.
Yeah.
And so, but so humble and approachable, and his science just applies to so many things. So,
yeah. And I think the humble and approachable is, you can't emphasize that enough when you get somebody of that actual stature. He's totally approachable, and he's brought along people that normally wouldn't have ended up with contact with people at that level. So
no, I totally get that. And I think that comes, and I don't know how much you guys really know. You know, he started off as a cardiologist and, you know, that work and then what he found. And I didn't mean for this to be all about him, but what he found was that it really was your brain that controlled all these physiologic observations he was making in the body. And that's what drove him to his initial research in the 80s. And I think of him as like almost an somewhat inventor of this whole space as he started and just kept iterating and doing many, many integrations and hundreds of studies, et cetera.
Yeah. You know, I've had him as a friend for a very long time, and he's a really quality person. Ended up having a couple of interactions with him yesterday, just letting him know Joel Lubar went into hospice. Evian needs to know. So
no, it's always hard.
Yeah. But his time to pass hasn't come yet. So
He's still working hard every day.
Yeah.
Don't take him off that board.
No, that's for sure.
No, that's so true.
No. No. Hi, Dr. Marie.
Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Nice to meet you.
Same here.
Say hi to Beverly. Beverly, who are you?
Well, hey, so Beverly, so how did Beverly get here? So Beverly is a healthcare consultant. And so Dr. Mari, you know, I started off 40 years ago, hate to say that out loud, but, you know, in acute care, like many people do. And then I transitioned more into the population health space. So I started working with health plans and vendors. And a lot of people don't know that, let's say, initiatives inside of health plans are actually a vendor service. So I did big programs for diabetes, heart disease, et cetera, trying to keep people healthy and out of the hospital. And through that work, what I found later is, you know, so many times behavioral health conditions really drive exacerbations of chronic disease. So then I kind of transitioned into this behavioral health guru as well, which is kind of funny from a total clinical medical background. But I ran a behavioral health department in a large blue here in the South. And so that's when I really found how many, you know, gaps in behavioral health care really cause all the utilization. After that, then I moved to Total Brain and working with Dr. Gordon. I was his clinical trainer, and I did that in just till a week ago, just so you know, and, you know, and helping them on initiatives for new products and the way we can run to market. Things did change. You know, Total Brain was purchased last year by another entity, and they just made some business decisions, which is why I'm not there anymore. Still love working with Evian, and I work with them on the side too. So that's who Beverly is.
Okay. And well, good intro there. I mean, it's. I think the way you presented that was most interesting, that you were so surprised to find. And I'd say so many people, you know, within our group and elsewhere, it just seems so obvious once you cross the threshold that, you know, everything is interconnected, shall we say, and how much money is spent on the wrong side of the line trying to help people.
No, absolutely. And it's so funny that you say it that way, because that's really how I was. I was like, and then your brain controls so many things. Really? And then little small steps or small things we do, which is really the topic of my discussion today and why I'm so alarmed about the topic that I'm bringing to you guys to really think about, because I don't necessarily believe people understand what they can do in infancy to their child could be having long-term harms. And so that's why I wanted to bring this to you. I did some research myself. I'll tell you, it came about because I'm a grandmother. I have lots of friends that were starting to have our grandchildren. And we noticed this trend. Like, everybody has a sound machine on with their baby. And hours and hours, using them all night, using them during the daytime naps. And intuitively, you know, us moms are like, is that really good? Do we know what the health outcomes are? So I came home and in my true Evian fashion, like started researching and going into the research papers. And I did uncover some things that I find very troubling. And, you know, I'm not a researcher. I'm a practical application of research for health outcomes. But I hope through your listeners, maybe someone will be sparked to do more investigation. That's my real goal here, that maybe they'll look into these and we'll have some better understanding of their implications.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I'll obviously we want to give you as much floor space as possible, but boy, oh boy, am I going to piggyback you in terms of a lot of the things that we work with or do supposedly for infants that really harms development. But I think Pete should run first here in terms of all of her lovely information. I'm chomping at the bit here.
We have shared screen ready to go. Go at it, Beverly.
All right. Give me just a second here. I'll pop it up. Let me know if you're seeing it. And I'll make it totally large. Are you seeing it there?
Yeah, sure do.
Well, so as I talked about before, you know, I came through my work with Total Brain. And so I just started diving into this and thought, you know, I'm not quite sure what we're doing to these brains. And so what I really want the takeaways today is for everybody to kind of rethink, oh, we got this brain safety first mechanism. And if we work on that and we alter what evolutionarily our brain has been doing for millions of years, you know, could that have an adverse impact that we're not going to see for years to come? But I think we're starting to see in some children, which is why, you know, my friends, we started talking about it. And then just review what I researched on infants, the American Association of Pediatrics, what their recommendations are. And I did actually come into a couple of really a very interesting animal model, which I know is not a human brain, but as I tell people, we don't dissect humans to really find what's going on. So we have to use animal models. That was the one that was most troubling to me. So I can't wait to share that with you. So the brain's 50,000 thoughts a day. I mean, I know we all know this from the National Science Foundation. Some people actually think it's even more, 70 or 80,000 thoughts a day. But that is your brain's way that you interpret the world. And it's always fight or flight for this risk reward. And so how you learn to perceive your world, even as an infant, is through experience. So you have to have hearing to interpret. Is that noise harmful? Do you shake and wake up? Etc. And so it's also a critical stage as well to hear these little snippets of language. I did dive into the research of that. And so, you know, if they're not getting these snippets in the background when they're asleep, which we all know they sleep 12 to 14 hours a day, does that have a negative impact on their brain development? Because it's a critical brain development stage. So I think it does. Okay, so the American Academy of Pediatrics. So that's Dr. Sophie Bach, and she looked into these machines, and her recommendation was that we really don't know that, you know, the children have the smaller ear canals. There could be a lot more sound that is amplified to them. And I really believe that as well. Plus, we all know whenever you're dealing with some manufactured product, there's a great degree of variance of the quality. And so, you know, just because they say they're at certain decibels, I think you could end up having more decibels than that for your baby. And maybe that's not good. You could even end up with hearing damage. And I think that concerns me as well, because they're, and I did talk to Dr. Gordon and Dr. Palmer about this inside Total Brain, because, you know, the ear canals are so small, so things get amplified. And then I did research in Dr. April Benoche. I think she's probably the world's foremost researcher into infant brain. And she had this great story. So it's experience dependent effects of the passive auditory exposure in infants. And it impacts that theta phase of synchrony, and it can predict later language expression, which really had me worried, because that's what intuitively my friends, so these grandmothers that I talk to, you know, what we all notice is that children don't seem to be talking as rapidly and earlier as they used to be. And so we wonder if this sound machine is affecting that. And April's work does really say that. But these short and intensive passive exposure to snippets of sound is what allows for the brain to learn to process and then have language. And so when you derail that, I think you're going to have the unforeseen consequences. This is the Dr. Sophie Bach, which is around the exposure and the ear canals being smaller. And they don't recommend using these. If you look at this, you know, if you, their sleep consultants that work with babies for sleep, if you look over across the board, there are very few that really recommend using these sound machines. And then the April Benoche work I just spoke of, I think her work is pivotal for this. Now, I do know that she has a new company, you guys may be aware of that, where she has a sound machine embedded with snippets of language, which I think is probably a better solution than total white noise. But I'd want to see a lot more evidence to its benefits over time. And I don't want to derail, you know, anything that she's doing, because I do feel greatly about her work. And I think it's very complementary to everything that people do. And she's the only one really researching into these brains like this. So the white noise, this is the one out of Toronto. It's actually a Canadian researcher. And so what Blake Papasan, and what he feels like it's really going to hurt hearing. And I think all of us who've been around medical for a long time, you think to OSHA rules and how much sound is allowed for employees all day. And then we've got these little babies with these little tiny ear canals with a machine that may or may not be at the decibel level you think it is. And you're using them for 12 to 16 hours a day. I don't see how that could really end up being beneficial. And I'm very concerned about it. And so, you know, he talks about not using them at all. And I'm really kind of in his camp now because I had an open mind when I first started researching. Intuitively, I felt they might be bad, but I wanted more evidence so I could make an informed decision. And that's what I found. So that's about don't use them. The ear canals are too small. We just don't know what the sound implications are. And then this was the one when I found this one, it just floored me. So this is Chang and Minaj. It was a few years ago. And this is the rat study where they exposed them to a moderate level of continuous white noise. And then when they dissected those brains, that auditory region of the brain behind the ear that is supposed to be developing was underdeveloped in these mice. And so this white noise is preventing that auditory development. Now, I know from my work with Evian that, you know, the brain has great degrees of neuroplasticity. And I would say intuitively, you know, people have a little, these children now have a little delayed speech, but they do pick it up and make it up later. I see in all of my friends' children, they go to speech therapy and get more intensive work later. Not all, but some. But my recommendation is, why create a problem that we don't have to have with a device that we don't really know that has any benefit? Other than I will say, you know, it does block out the sound so children don't get distracted when they're asleep. Is that a good or a bad thing? And so my real summary in this, I don't think these should be used for long periods of time. I hope, Dr. Murray, that's what you think as well. Cut them off. Don't use them all the time. And then, you know, as a parent, you do have to be proactive for your child. And you can't just follow, you know, marketing and what people want to sell. You're your brain, you're your child's first brain advocate. And I think evolutionary wise, allowing them to experience sounds is the critical brain development of that milestone. And when you circumvent that, I believe you're just opening the door for unforeseen problems in the future.
Nice. What's going on in the brain, Jay?
There's a difference between auditory white noise input and the brain having stimulation with white noise or pink noise or brown noise, which are the most common. There are other colors of noise as well. Random frequency noise stimulation in the into the brain has been used clinically. There's a lot of studies on it, comparing higher frequency and lower frequency random frequencies. And let me piece about noise. So that these are from Dirk de Ritter, who is gracious enough to always share all of his slide deck with everybody. So the brain basically uses noise to enhance the resolution of brain activity. As you add some noise on top of this base figure, it resolves itself more and more, but too much ends up being too much. So there's a point of diminishing return. But noise can be used to improve the signal. Again, white noise it can be used, but it's not physiologic. Pink noise, 1/F is pink noise, and that basically the kind of noise that the brain ends up using effectively for enhancing resolution. A lot of increased benefit for resolution early on, and then the benefit declines across time. But one of the things it points to is that the brain is not a linear system. because linear systems just don't that they don't have this kind of a response. So the brain's a non-linear system, and for hearing, if you lose the high frequencies in your hearing, you lose the stochastic resonance, and you really do have a very severe hearing loss at that point. Replacing those frequencies ends up giving you a better resolution. Just the base aspects of hearing, you do lose quite a bit of what you can understand. So they can do random frequency stim, white noise, various kinds of noise. This is random frequency noise stimulation, high frequency and low frequency. They're supposedly touting improved learning or worsening of learning with the higher or lower frequencies. All sorts of studies. The bottom line is that there was no clinical impact. So random frequency stimulation, you know, a transcranial, really does not, the research is in, the results are, it doesn't work. So random frequency noise stimulation is essentially ineffective. However, you can see the pink noise, 1 over F, and as you increase the degree of higher frequency loss, pink noise and then brown noise, and black or darker noise as well. So the stimulation, you can see here for food addiction, they did stimulation at the targeting the anterior cingulate. They end up having an electrode at the frontal midline and 4 reference electrodes around the side, and they use that to generate pink noise and influence the cingulate as opposed to just surface cortex. And with 6 sessions of 1 milliamp, which is not a really high current density, it is a lot of studies are much higher current density, but appropriately, the higher the current density, the more skin effect you have. But you're really not trying to get them to have a skin effect. You're trying to get a brain effect without overstimulating. But basically, they had a positive impact on anterior cingulate function using pink noise stimulation, and changed the craving aspect of food addiction. So stimulation, not through your ears, but across transcranial electrically, can end up having impacts on brain function from increasing resolution by stochastic resonance to activating or inactivating cortex based on the kind of stimulation that's done. Anyway, it's not the same concept of stimulation as listening to white noise.
Maybe I can jump in and link here if people will say. I think we're talking about now 3 different things, and I don't want our viewers to get too confused here. If I can just take it down a level and then come back up to the differences in pink and white noise and the positive values as opposed to the negative values. But I think, Beverly, you pointed out something very interesting, and I think it was hinted at in the research, but I'm not sure it was explicitly said. But this really ties into some of the work that I've been doing also many colleagues, in terms of it's not what the brain is learning, it's what the brain isn't learning. So I'm looping back into all of the screen time, and there was some earlier studies on, they were actually language learning. And I don't know, do people remember the Baby Einstein program that was just touted as the best thing since sliced bread? Everybody was buying it, and all the little kids were Einsteins until they realized that in fact the children that were following that program had reduced vocabulary acquisition instead of increased. So people are like, what the heck? And what it was is that the child was so intense on focusing, so it had an analgesic effect of everything else in the background. So essentially, yes, they might have learned the vocabulary from the program, but that was the only thing they learned. They didn't hear whether it was mom or sibling or so and so in the background. They had none of the standard, I would say, passive input. And if I recall the study correctly, for every hour a child attended to these, shall we say, analgesic language learning programs, they learned 6 to 8 words less. So again, sorry, it's not what the frequently what a program is doing, it's what it's not doing. And this is where I want to loop into exactly what Beverly said, that it takes away all of the background noise. And if a child is literally sleeping, depending on the age, or an infant, from 20, 18 to 20 hours a day. Even when we're sleeping, we're not completely passive. So, what is a child actually absorbing? What is a child actually absorbing during sleep? I would say sound, okay? And maybe sensation, cold and warmth and things like this. But the primary thing I would say is sound. And here I'm going to loop back into attachment and safety. If you have white noise on all the time and the child doesn't hear any background noises, they don't learn that the neighbor's dog barking means absolutely nothing. It's not dangerous. They don't learn that pots clanking in the kitchen is not a dangerous sound. In fact, it comes with the family being happy because everybody eats. I mean, I could go on and on and on, but I really think that there's a tie-in, not only with language learning, Beverly, but with anxiety. And as far as I know, nobody is looking at that. So I really thank you for bringing that to our attention. And all of these things that we do can actually end up harming children. My last little comment before I go on to plan B here is also, who is the white noise for, right? Is it actually to help the child sleep, or is it for parental reprieve? And that is not a criticism of parents. The first thing I say is parents are overworked, stressed to the hilt, and they really, really need their reprieve. But it shouldn't be by artificially sedating a child so that they don't react to their environment, which is a very, very healthy thing. I'm not talking about colic or anything like that. So that's my part A. Should I go right into part B, Pete? Do I have your permission? Okay, here goes part B. What Jay was talking about in terms of all the noises. Yeah, white noise, nah. But I don't know if people are aware of the work that we do at the Swingle Clinic. We do tons of work with harmonics. We prescribe harmonics to, I would say, 80% of our clients, and we always embed them in pink noise. Okay. The other thing we do is we do prescriptions on time. And exactly what Jay was saying, there is very much a thing as too much. Right. So the therapeutic value of harmonics, the therapeutic value of using noise is fantastic. But this mass commercialization of, green noise, I think, is the most popular now. Tons and tons.
Where did these colors come from?
Jay,
I
do
mean,
you want to take over there?
is it a fraction? Is it a frequency? Like, how do we pick these colors? 'Cause I know people that just use the colors and they don't get what it means. It's white noise is just static. Could somebody explain it to me?
White noise across the frequency spectrum from higher frequency to lower frequency that's in it ends up having across 100% all the way across. It's just random noise across the spectrum. Pink noise is 1 over F. Now, 1 over F is a thing that you hear when you learn about EEG. 1 over F. The higher the frequency, the smaller the signal. So this is a taper. White noise is high, shh,
irritating.
Really, really irritating. Pink noise is kind of, but the high frequency is gone. And then brown noise is 1 over F squared, I believe. And that gives you even deeper noise. Now, spectral contouring gives you different colors. And, you know, you can experiment with it yourself. A frequency that's a match for one person's endogenous tuning may not be a good match for somebody else's.
Yeah.
If you go in there with your brain all jacked up with beta, you're probably going to respond to a different approach than somebody that comes in there with slow alpha, theta, under arousal kind of a thing. So everybody's going to have a match. So luckily, most of these things allow you to play around with an assortment of colored sounds till you find one that you find comfortable. I would still counsel you to use it judiciously. You can use it for a short period of time. Usually the intention is a short period of time to kind of calm before you go to bed. But not to leave it on all night. These things have usually a timer, you know, short duration that will turn it off. It's essentially the spectral contour. Now, being a musician yourself, you understand you play bass. That would be like more brown noise, and somebody that
some people call it some other type of noise.
But you know, you've got somebody wailing on a lead guitar with a high frequency. That's a whole different frequency range, and they have different effects. So,
well, I mean, it's just if we just take this down a level, you know, the white noise is essentially full spectrum, and then what you do is typically just take off the top as the colors go darker, so to speak. But what, you know, Jay was saying, the issue is with continuous, right? And again, in full transparency, we use this all the time, you know, and I personally do not like what noise. It's far too arousing, but as a stimulant, yeah. Okay. But very short period of time. And again, you kind of have to know what the EEG is. If you have somebody who is kind of revving at a higher arousal rate and you get that color wrong, same type of thing. You know, if you start playing around with brown or what's popularly called green noise, you know, you can actually sedate. So the issue again is continuous. Now, for example, the one time that we do break our own rule is when you have acute, and I mean acute, torturous insomnia. Okay. But that's not the case with infants. And in fact, I really, really question how you are training the brain to not be able to manage or develop its own sleep cycle and you know, then moving into circadian rhythm. So pardon my directness again, we're really screwing with development here. Don't do it. Just don't do it.
Does tinnitus come into play in any of this?
It can. I mean, one of the treatments for tinnitus is finding the frequency of the or the pitch of the sound the person hears, and essentially matching and then playing with the alteration of perception. But Jay will know much more about this than I do. I put tinnitus in the same classification as headaches. You know, the second you think you understand them, you don't. And a headache is not a headache is not a headache. The same thing with tinnitus. There are multiple causes. Do you want to take it up a level, Jay?
We can look at different kinds of tinnitus. You can have tinnitus from taking too many aspirin. That's an inflammatory neurochemical change. But tinnitus due to hearing loss is what most people end up having. And at that point, you lose a frequency. And that frequency is no longer going through the thalamus to the cortex. The auditory cortex is in the temporoparietal junction, kind of buried down inside. And it's a point-by-point representation of the cochlea. And the little hair cells in the cochlea will have died off at a frequency because too much rock and roll, playing loud music, shooting guns, flying aircraft with hearing protection, stupid stuff you do.
Earpods.
Stupid stuff you do as a kid, you know, you can end up with hearing loss. And sometimes it's specific to a frequency because of a specific frequency that blew it out. But sometimes you just have a cliff and all the high frequencies are gone. Now, the thalamus, when it relays a nothing is coming in to the cortex, that thalamocortical column is going to slow. And instead of being, what's the ideal 10, you know, alpha varies, but let's say it's a 10 hertz alpha, and it no longer has an input. Well, that's going to slow and slow and slow and slow and slow. When it gets down to about 6 cycles a second, and that's outside the alpha traditional definition, it turns off the lateral inhibition. And the surrounding frequencies take over that spot. And you hear it as a phantom sound. The same as cutting off an arm, you may end up having phantom pain because you touch the face, and on the homunculus, the face is next to the hand and you lost the hand. So you get a pain in the hand from input from the face that goes into the hand area and it's perceived as pain. So a phantom sound is tinnitus, phantom pain is obviously pain or other kinds of pain. These are thalamocortical dysrhythmias, and the slowed alpha has gamma frequencies surrounding it during the invasion of the lateral inhibition being gone. And that gamma is on, permanently on. It's not chirpy gamma, a little burst of gamma like normal healthy function. It's just rip-roaringly on. So Dirk de Ritter has a machine learning algorithm that can identify slowed alpha surrounded by a little gamma. And they use Hilbert transform to look at the gamma rhythmicity, and they use obviously just a simple spectra looking for the theta peak. And that can identify accurately and differentiate patients from tinnitus, pain, movement disorders like Parkinsonism, and then reward deficiency, which includes depression, OCD, food addiction, drug addiction, motivational, anterior cingulate is really creative. It can do lots of things and it can mess up lots of things. And, but the reward deficiency has been well written up by Kenneth Blum as a general topic. So you can kind of read about the entire catch basin of bad things that can happen when your cingulate is not working.
What about kids that can't hear if they're deaf?
Like, I missed that. I'm sorry.
Deaf. Kids that are deaf can't hear. If white noise does something to the development of the child, does that mean that deaf kids are underdeveloped in a part of their brain, or am I looking at that the wrong way?
In fact, if you're deaf and you're not getting an input into the brain, they'll first diagnose that with brainstem auditory evoke responses, BEAR testing, BAER. And they'll put an electrode on the top of your head. They'll put a couple references in the temporal area, like A1, A2. They'll put a ground on the forehead. They're basically just measuring CZ. And CZ is where the auditory event-related potential arrives. You'd think, well, why the hell is it up at the top of the head? Because the auditory cortex is in the side, but it's in the side buried between two, and it's actually pointing up towards the top of your head. So from the sides here on the top side of the temporal lobe at the back, they're actually oriented up to the top of your head. So the field projected from the pyramidal cells in the auditory cortex are picked up top. And with that testing, they can literally identify the tympanic membrane, the hammer animal stir up the bones in the ear, the cochlea, the cochlear pons, the colliculi, all the steps all the way to the cortex. So if you're deaf, they are going to know exactly where and why you're deaf. Is this a cochlea problem? Is a brainstem pons issue? A stroke in the brainstem? Is it the actually the mechanism in the ear? The little tiny bones didn't develop properly. They're going to identify it perfectly. And if you're missing a cochlea, you'd think, well, that's it. There's you're toast, you know, you're never going to hear. But they have cochlear implants, so they can actually implant and the person can hear. Now, the funny thing about that is that everybody's happy when little Johnny can hear mom say, "I love you, little Johnny." You know, everybody goes, "Oh, look, Johnny can hear his mom," and everybody's happy. Little Johnny's even happy. But little Johnny wants to turn that damn thing off fairly quickly because of all the noise, you know. But that's the richness of your auditory environment. It's your stochastic resonance. And if you turn it off, you'll never learn to hear. And you have to learn, oh, that I didn't know that beep was actually the microwave. You know, oh, we have a beep on the refrigerator door. You know, that you hear subtleties in your environment that you might think of as noise, but you know, it's your auditory environment and you have to learn to hear. And if you turn the damn thing off, you won't learn to hear.
Yeah. So, can I just jump in? I want to really emphasize Jay's point. It kind of loops into some of the things that I was talking about a bit earlier on a less sophisticated level, perhaps. But know that you're literally thwarting development. You are not permitting an infant to, as Jay said, to learn how to hear. But the key thing is to differentiate a child in all that time. I was again talking about a larger level of pots banging and dogs, but what Jay was saying is like all these little subtle, like what to tune in and tune out, literally. Also when, you know, sometimes we need to tune into a conversation. Sometimes we need to tune out or want to tune out. So I would say, selective perception or selective attention. None of this is being learned. One of the things we do know about sources of insomnia, one is the lack of development of selective attention to sound in a safe environment. And that leads into the second one. A lot of individuals who have trauma in their life, that has been turned off because it was a safety measure. For example, people who grew up in a home with a raging alcoholic, people who unfortunately, you know, were assaulted, sexually assaulted, that almost always happens in the evening. So they're very, very attentive to sound. So none of this is being learned, you know, for better, for worse. Yeah, I think we could go on and on. I'm really appreciative, Beverly, because I don't think this is a topic we naturally would have gone on to if you hadn't pushed the button here.
Thank you so very much. I've learned so much. You know, I feel like, you know, that grandmother or nurse instinct, I may not have the high level scientific understanding that everything that's gotten articulated over the last 15 minutes, but intuitively, you know, your brain does need to learn. And I'm very concerned about the anxiety portion because, you know, in treating people with behavioral health conditions, stress, anxiety is usually the gateway. So if we prevent this whole population of children from learning how to adjust to their environment, what are repercussions down the road in a big population environment? So this has been fascinating to me. I just cannot thank you enough.
If you get the amygdala, the emotional processor of the brain, all jacked up with the primary emotion, usually anxiety or fear, could be anger too, but a primary emotion, it changes the thalamic gating and the sensitivity to sound and the sensitivity to sight. All of your senses have an enhanced thalamic throughput. So they arrive cortically earlier and larger than they normally would be. So you're jumpy. Your nervous system is jumpy. That little sound that should have been a little bit of nothing ends up being amplified, and the person responds to it. And in the EEG, you see visual hypervigilance with people that have anxiety or PTSD, lambda at the back of the head, which is the P100 wave of vision. And with the eyes closed, you'll see vertex activity, not vertex sharp wave of sleep, but vertex activity. They're sensitive to sound, and they're getting P100s at CZ. Now, a giant P100 is during stage two is a vertex sharp wave, and if you have a really good sleep spindle, you continue to drift off to sleep, and SMR is that sleep spindle. So we can help people that have hyperactive nervous systems, stabilize them using the traditional neurofeedback approaches of stabilization training using SMR, and to a certain extent also alpha or alpha theta style training, where you can train hypoperfusion to get rid of hyperperfusion of excess beta in a jumpy system.
When would you want to give a child a QEEG to see if there's dysregulation? Like at what age, see if there's a problem with hearing or that could affect it?
That's going to usually be caught in the hospital. If the child in the nursery is not responding to sound in some fashion, a general arousal, they don't have to orient to like where it came from necessarily specifically, but if they're not responding to sound at all, the nurses in a neonatal intensive care area or just a neonatal care area that's their job, and they're good at it. And they're going to spot the one that's lethargic or non-responsive, and they can say, "Hey, doc, this one might not be able to hear. Let's order a bear," and have the EEG tech come in and hook them up and do some brainstem artery evoked responses and tell you exactly what works and what doesn't work on their hearing. That'll be taken care of really just on a routine basis. Lack of vision or visual disabilities are a little harder to come by as a detailed analysis that early, but if they're totally visually non-responsive, they'll usually do some testing there as well.
I was going to say the baseline, like how old do you want to go on to get that, you know?
There are databases that have age ranges down to like 6 months and a year old, but I've actually seen norms. So they said that was normal, and I've looked at the EEG, and it was at that age, 6 months and 1 year, epileptiform content in the EEG. That's classic epileptiform content that was still within the normal range. So the normal range of variability at a very young age is so wide that the databases are really kind of useless, in my opinion. And the bulk of the databases don't go that young. It's I think, a fool's errand. You can get reliably down to about 5 years old, but the maturational changes from birth to a few years old are so dramatic. If you're actually doing EEG testing on somebody who's less than a year old, you've got to know the gestational age. There's a certification, a board examination for an electroencephalographer, a neurologist or a psychiatrist who wants to be a specialist in EEG. Pardon the accompaniment of the dog in the back here. He's very vocal.
It's our co-host.
Rhodesia Ridgebacks are very vocal, and he's singing for us. So, and anyway, that hijacked my train of thought. So,
Well, I can fill in a little bit here. One of the things that You know, we also have to remember not just criticize databases, but, you know, textbook numbers are averages. So there's incredible variation. You know, this is supposed to happen at 3 months, and this is supposed to happen at 3 months and 20 days. Those are averages. So I would say, you know, parental instinct is pretty good. If you think something isn't quite right, get it checked out. And as Jay said, I think we're much, much, much better now. But I would say even as far back as 20 years, my gosh, there were children being diagnosed with horrible learning disabilities. And the miracle of glasses. It's humorous now, but it was tragic at the time. But apart from a vision that every once in a while slips by, mama's gut is pretty good. Yeah. No apologies for genderism here. Mama's gut is pretty good.
The gender difference between sexes in the EEG during the developmental trajectory are rather astounding.
Yeah.
Before they had the data, they just grouped them together. But if you hang out with young kids and you're, you know, preschool through elementary school, you see the girls will have a maxillofacial surge at a different point than the guys will. And their maxillofacial surges tend to have some out of phase content. And they're actually EEG components that can end up showing differences between male and female at specific age.
Yeah.
So actually getting the data specific to gender it ends up being really important for the developmental trajectory. And then it again becomes important later in life, 45, 50 years old on up. Females have a lot of beta in the EEG, a lot of gamma in the EEG, and males kind of go electrically silent.
Males go slow while women wake up.
Yeah. So, and if you average lots of beta gamma with not much of anything, what do you get? Something you'd rather get compared to. You know, a woman isn't going to want to be compared to a dumbed down average, and a guy's going to look like he doesn't, you know, he's not even at the average. And, you know, so you should be sensitive to the advances in neuroscience. And when NIH says you can't just study males in something, or you can't just study females in something, you've got to actually have male and female mix. You know, some rare things like birth control probably is not going to be tested on males if it's intended for women, but you basically end up having to judge male and female. And there are databases now that have the ability to judge them differentially. So it's like getting a new version of the IQ test. You use the new version, you know, you don't keep publishing with the old stuff. So there's a couple of databases now internationally that have stepped up and added more clients in order to be able to split the database into male and female. You can't just take the ones you have and split them and that's it, because you will have insufficient numbers to characterize the age ranges. So it's a lot of work, but it's the right work to do. And luckily, it's being done more and more now.
But Beverly Hansen, somebody's watching this show right now, wants to learn more about what you're doing. Where do we send them?
Well, I guess send them to my LinkedIn profile. I do social media. I do consult for both health plans and then vendor services companies, as I talked about before. So happy to always have a conversation. I have that contact info in the slide deck that I shared. And again, I am so thankful. Dr. Mari, your insights have helped me. Jay, come on. I mean, I'm just happy to have been here. So thank you all for this.
Our pleasure. As I said,
Marie,
thanks for pushing the button. Important.
Dr. Marie J. Gunkelman, Beverly Hansen, thank you for another, and the Pooch, another fantastic Neuro Noodle, Neuro Feedback podcast. Take care, all.
Bye.
Okay. All right, bye-bye. Thanks. Bye bye.
The NeuroNoodle podcast is supported by listeners and businesses just like you.